Welcome to Better Cybersecurity, the ISF podcast. I'm your host, Steve Durbin.
ISF Chief Executive Steve Durbin is an expert in leadership, business culture transformation, and cyber strategies for today's top enterprises. I'm producer Tavia Gilbert. Today, we bring back one of our favorite guests, former U.S. most wanted cyber criminal Brett Johnson. It's been 7 years since he was last on the show, and much has happened in the world of cyber. Brett shares how his perspective has changed in the past few years and gives his thoughts on how new technologies impact cybercrime. Steve and Brett discuss compliance and what Brett's path from prison to helping law enforcement means for other cybercriminals. Brett also answers some rapid-fire questions.
Brett, it's fantastic to see you after all this time. Been 7, going on 8 years. 2019 was the last time we did this.
Yeah, I still remember that. It was a great podcast, and I appreciate you bringing me back on.
Good to have you back in the hot seat again. I wanted just to get a bit of a perspective from you on how the cybercrime space has changed since we last spoke. So 2019 to 2026, how has it all changed from your point of view?
You know, what's interesting is I had a gentleman, a professor, reach out to me, and he asked me to answer some questions for him. This is like a week and a half ago. One was how that perspective had changed. Another was what I did not realize when I was actively a criminal compared to now that I'm on the good side. All right. When I was a criminal, I did not appreciate the degree of victimization and the damage that was being caused. All right. I did not appreciate. Now I understand if you're a criminal and you're ripped off by another criminal or another criminal in your group misbehaves, it's not like you can call the local police department and report them. So how do you maintain discipline and order within criminal communities? And the answer is through the threat of violence. If you're trying to run an organization, a criminal organization, you have to be willing to enact violence. If someone is going to rat or snitch on you, and you're looking at potentially 20 years, 40 years, or life, what are you willing to do in order not to be caught? Are you willing to enact that violence? And the answer today is most people, yes, they are. All right. So that's one of the things. The other thing that's really changed is when I was actively committing crime, even up until a few years ago, in order for you to be successful at cyber attacks and cyber crime, you had to understand the dynamics of those attacks. You had to understand your own operational security so that you weren't identified. You had to understand the security of the target that you were trying to pick. You had to understand how to use the tools, how to run drop addresses, launder money, make fake IDs, what have you. These days, that's no longer an issue. These days, everything is off the shelf, products, tools, services, tutorials. Hell, you can buy a tutorial for $15. You can take a live instruction class for anywhere from $300 up to $3,000. Master fraudster will take you by the hand and walk you through that attack. Today, a person can enter into the environment, not understand any dynamic of any type of attack or crime they're trying to commit, and they can be successful. There's a reason that cybercrime today is the third largest economy on the planet. And that's largely the reason. The other reason is that I've been on the good side now for a few years. And I'm very fortunate that I get to work with law enforcement, that for some damn reason, I'm respected in this space. And like law enforcement, for example, we've got 37,000 FBI employees spread across 56 field offices in the United States. Only about 300 are concentrated on cybercrime. About 300. So you've got manpower problems, you've got jurisdictional problems, all these things add in, plus the internet itself lends itself to anonymity. You've got those issues that lead to cybercrime being that third largest economy.
I wanted to talk to you about technology, so I'm glad that you've alluded to that. AI, everybody talks about AI. People are terrified that AI is going to create these super hackers. But, you know, as you've just pointed out, the skill sets, if I put it that way, the training to become a better cyber criminal than you were at the start is out there anyway. Is the real 2026 threat, do you think, not down to that sort of old-fashioned alpha predator that was out there, of which maybe you would see yourself having been all those years ago, but in the fact that now we've got potentially millions of fairly average criminals who are now suddenly going to be made much more competent because they can access AI, because they can access all of these differences in technology and have that infrastructure of support that you've just alluded to that is so widely available?
That's the problem, right? A lot of people, it's not just a lot of people. We've got 8,500 plus security companies. We've got a lot of mass media that call attackers, and I don't want to use the word hackers because we're not. We are criminals. We're attackers. Some of us are those alpha predators. Yeah, I would be that at one point in my life. That's absolutely the case, but most people are not that. Most people, if anything, they're very good social engineers, if that. You're right in what you're saying. It's not zero-day attacks. It's not those computer geniuses that mass media and security companies try to scare us into believing. That's not the issue. The issue is we've got a lot of people out there that are willing to do things that no one else will do. That's what the issue is. Now, those people that are willing to do that, largely, they are not skilled at much of anything. And the problem is exactly what you said. The problem is that technology and the user interface is becoming nice enough, easy enough, and ubiquitous enough that those people that are willing to do things, they don't really need the skill level to do those things that they're willing to do. If you're trying to guard your system against 10 people that are trying 10 different things, there's a difference between that and trying to guard your system against a million people. Right. That are trying to do maybe several different things, but all of those several different things are aided by AI systems which are scanning the environment, which know the exploits that are most common, that are identifying those exploits, and then are telling those would-be attackers how to enter in through those exploits. That's the issue. And it's a big issue. We're already past the point that research tools are able to accurately monitor and report on the advancement of AI systems. It's absolutely going to get to the point where that's out of touch with us. We have attackers that are using that to an extent right now. We don't have a lot of those hundreds of thousands or millions of attackers that are using that yet. But you give it another 14 months, that's absolutely going to be the case because the user interface is going to be better, the ease of use is better, the education across the board on how to use those systems is better because there will be tutorials out there. There will be forums or criminal forums that are open that are teaching people how to use these AI systems to launch attacks. So you're going to have all that in play. And the problem is that on the good guy side, even with AI, we are still reactive. Those attacks have to launch. Those attacks have to be successful. After those attacks are successful, then the AI system can come in, learn from those attacks, and then mitigate those attacks and hopefully be able to mitigate any type of innovations on those attacks so that they can stop those. But for right now, no, that's not going to be the case. It's a reactive stance still.
Yeah, it's interesting that you say that. You know, one of the questions I was going to ask you was, where do we go from here? Because we can spend, and indeed have done for many years now, spent tremendous amount of resource, whether that be people, whether it be money, trying to tackle and block all the time people attacking. Right. Some of the things I've been talking about in the more recent past are about moving away from that into the world of a resilient organization that accepts that you're going to have a certain amount of attack taking place. Right. It accepts you're going to have an amount of data that's going to be exfiltrated, but focusing very much down on your crown jewels, the things that you have to protect at all costs, and looking at how you're going to then recover from some kind of attack. But that's almost like running up a flag and declaring defeat. What's your perspective on it? That's what I'm curious to hear.
I don't think it is declaring defeat. I truly don't. I talk in every presentation I give, I talk about knowing your place in the cybercrime spectrum or the cyber attack spectrum, if you will. And what I mean by that is that depending on who you are, absolutely determines how I'm going to attack you and what I'm looking for. All right. Just because I'm able to enter into your system doesn't mean I'm going to be able to get what I want. Those crown jewels, for example. Okay. So that becomes the real part that people need to be aware of. Attackers, you can't stop attacks. No, it's mitigate. You can't stop everything. We can mitigate attacks. You need to concentrate on what attackers are actually looking for, what they're wanting, how they're actually going to attack you. That threat landscape that's out there, it's not because you've got computer geniuses that are pinging the environment looking for open spaces. There are people who are opportunists that are scanning that, knowing that 90% plus of every single attack uses a known exploit. It's not zero-day attacks. That's the problem. It's those types of stats that paint that threat landscape that's out there. If you understand that, you can start to scan your environment, look for the open exploits that are out there, and then understand, well, what's important to an attacker in my business? Yeah, I think I said before when I spoke to you that if you have a business or service that makes money, an attacker will seek to make money using that same product, business, or service.
Right.
That's still the case, but at the same time, there's something specific to your business or yourself or your organization that I'm wanting. And what is that? That's the crown jewels of your sphere. Understand that and then seek to guard that. All right. And the same thing applies to ransomware attacks or business email compromise attacks. You know, what is an attacker looking for? Well, if it's ransomware, he's looking for someone that can pay that ransom. He's looking for someone that needs that data. So if the data itself is your crown jewels, what do you need to do? Well, we already know what you need to do. We've been preaching that for years, right? We already know that. We already know that human beings tend to be the weak link in most security. We know that attackers, most of them are not, the vast majority of them are not skilled. We know that 90% plus of those attacks use known exploits, that it's not the stuff we don't know about. It's the stuff we've been told about for years and we've not done anything about. That creates those opportunities for those attackers. Cybersecurity and security overall is not a romantic thing. It's not an exotic thing. It's simply doing the nuts and bolts of what you need to do. And the problem is that largely that's not happening in the environment. If you've got management that's more interested in butter than they are in guns, you've got those types of issues. You've got management that doesn't understand that, hey, you know, that attack, when it happens, not if, but when it happens, it's going to cost you a lot more money in trust and in dollars than if you would have just implemented or done the nuts and bolts of what you needed to do to begin with.
How do you get that message across? Because you've made the point, you knew you're very active on the circuit. You talked to a lot of companies about this kind of thing. What are the sort of things you use to get that message across?
Of course, I tell my personal story.
Yep.
And I think that matters not just from showing that a criminal can change, which most of us cannot, let's be honest. We can't. Mm-hmm. We choose not to. It's not only that, but it shows the mindset, the resilience, the willingness, the cognitive dissonance. It shows all those things that are inherent in those attackers, and it's inherent in every single attacker that's out there. It shows the ego. Yeah, today I've still got a huge ego problem, but it shows that as well. If you start to understand the attackers, if you start to be truthful about the attackers in the cybersecurity space and what's needed to actually be done, and not embellish and lie and try to spear fear and uncertainty and doubt, if you're honest, I believe that people respond to that. You walk through how an attack happens. Step by step, I take the George Orwell approach of not using a 50-cent word when a dime word will suffice. I take that approach of trying to be plain spoken, and it tends to make a difference. But at the same time, we have a huge problem. God, we have a huge problem overall with everything. But you take cybersecurity awareness training or fraud prevention training, scam awareness, anything like that. We tend to educate at a very rational level.
Right.
For scams and a lot of fraud and stuff like that, it doesn't happen at a rational level. If I'm trying to attack a person and compromise that person, I'm not doing it at a rational level. I'm doing it at an emotional level. I'm trying to get you to set reason and logic aside and to react emotionally. So all that training takes place at that rational level. You can understand it there. That doesn't mean that you understand it at the emotional level whatsoever. I think we have to redo a lot of the things that we're doing so that we understand that. Right now, it's a dog and pony show. You know, right now we're compliance training. Okay, you're doing compliance training. At least that says you did something at the end of the day. But are you doing training that actually addresses how attackers operate, their mindset, how they pick targets, how they collaborate, share, and exchange information? Are you doing stuff like that? Are you walking through how those attacks exactly happen? No, you're not. You're not. You're showing some victim in a video or writing some or doing an interview with them or what have you that shows that they lost money or they lost data or what have you. So what? That shows the outcome. That shows that that attack was successful. It doesn't really educate you on anything at all.
I've heard you say that the hardest part of a crime isn't the hack, the crime itself, is getting the money.
Right.
So I wanted to ask you, with what we're hopefully seeing as being tighter crypto regulations, digital currencies, is it actually harder to be a successful criminal today than it was, say, 10 to 12 years ago, even with all of the new advances in technology that we've seen?
That's a good question. We've got Monero now. We've got a lot of chatter about fraud using the Tether network. I am not a fan of crypto. I'm not. I would be ecstatic if the entire thing went belly up. I truly would. Leave some of the technology that's been developed, but get rid of every single crypto token on the planet, and I think we would be a better people. Is it harder? In one respect, it is. It's because we now have people that are aware of how money is moved, what criminals seek to do with it. Banks have become more aware of a lot of the new ways to launder and funnel funds. In many ways, it's much harder. But at the same time, criminal networks have adapted to that difficulty. So you're seeing a network of criminals that understand finally that the most important part, I don't care if you're gathering the data. I don't care if you're committing the crime. If you're not cashing it out, you're useless. They are now really appreciating that. So networks have evolved to the point that you're seeing people that are sharing, exchanging, and collaborating together to seek the easiest financial institution that they can hit, launching the attack against that institution, and then looking for people who have accounts already open at that institution. So in some respects, it's become much harder. In other respects, the criminal groups have evolved to the point where they understand that, and they've responded appropriately to it.
One of the other things I wanted to ask you was, you're one of the few who actually made it out, went legit. We've said that. If you look at the landscape in 2026, do you think that the path to redemption that you took is still open for the next generation of cyber criminals, or do you think that's something in the past now?
I work with the FBI. During the pandemic, I had an agent that told me that, Brett, you don't understand the importance of what you're doing. And I was like, yeah, I know, I'm getting word out and everything. He's like, no. He said, it's also important that you need to understand that right now you're laying the path for other people who will come after you if someone does make that choice to change their lives. The answer is, yeah, it's still there. Mm-hmm. But, and there's a but. The problem is that I had a professor from DePaul. She asked on a podcast, she was like, if you were a black man, do you think you'd have the same opportunity? And should I tell the truth? I was like, No, I would not. I'm a white guy. I'm not viewed as very threatening. I'm very personable. People tend to like me. I'm energetic. I'm friendly. People don't understand that you don't make the United States Most Wanted list because you're a good person. Mm-hmm. If I were a person of color, I don't think that I would have those opportunities at all. So I think that plays into it. Race absolutely plays into it. What also plays into it is that it's choice. It's choice. So when I made the choice to turn my life around, it mattered because without that choice, it would have never happened. And I had people throughout my history that tried to get me to do the right damn thing. It was my choice, but at the same time, I had people that put their careers on the line to give me that opportunity. Those people didn't know if I would ever do the right thing, if I would go back and commit crime. They didn't know, but they gave me that chance, that opportunity. I had the cybersecurity and fraud industry at large, and it was crazy, but at large, they really didn't complain. They were open arms saying, yeah, how can you help us? How can you assist? Mm-hmm. What can you do? I think that still exists. The fraud prevention people, cybersecurity people, they tend to be very, even law enforcement, they tend to be very, very open and welcoming to people who really mean to help. Right. Now, that being said, the problem is that when I started speaking and consulting, there really wasn't a lot of criminals on the circuit. There were a couple. There was me. There was Frank Abagnale, maybe one or two others. Mm-hmm. Now we've got a lot more. Mm-hmm. And some of those people, they regret their actions in the past. Most of them do not. Most of them are simply financing the same type of mindset just with a legal profession. I would say if you're not sorry for the crimes that you've committed and the people that you've victimized, what are you doing? You're not worth having it in any environment at all. And certainly when I began speaking and consulting, I did not appreciate the damage that I'd caused, the people that I had victimized. When I was a criminal, I didn't care about my victims. I didn't. But when I got on the good guy's side and started working with victims, to this day, I have people that reach out to me that have been victimized. And typically they think that because I used to be this guy, that I can get their money back. And that's not the case. The case is I'm typically the person that has to tell them that they're not getting their money back. But because I was able to interact and I had that opportunity to interact, and I still do, with victims, I started to develop that empathy and understand the damage that I'd caused. So I'm not saying that just because you're coming, you're out of prison and you're trying to do the right thing and you're not yet sorry for what you've done. I'm not saying not to give that person a chance, but I am saying that if you don't see some sort of significant change, if you don't see that they are growing as a human being and they've been doing this shit for a while, what are you doing even engaging with this individual? That's what I'm saying. Is that opportunity still there? It is. But we have to be very aware of who we're engaging with, the damage that's caused. Like, for example, I'm still not allowed today to touch networks. That's the type of guardrails that need to be in place. And I earned that. No, I'm not a really technical guy, but I'm a guy that has shown his willingness to do things others will not. So those guardrails, that awareness, that caution always has to be in place when dealing with people who have shown that willingness.
Got some quick fire questions for you. Here we go. What's more dangerous in 2026, a state-sponsored hacker or a 16-year-old with a Telegram account?
16-year-old.
Why?
You thought I was going to say state-sponsored. For me right now, it's those 16-year-olds. I don't think that the nation states right now have gotten to the point where they're going to launch those attacks that are destroying the infrastructure of financial institutions or electric grids or water supplies or what have you. Because I think that at that point, it would be considered an act of war. So they're not yet willing to do that. That 16-year-old is willing to do anything.
Okay, fair. If you could delete one technology from the planet to make everybody safer, what would it be?
Crypto.
Crypto.
Yeah.
Biggest cybersecurity lie that people still believe in 2026?
Hackers.
Hackers.
It's hackers. We've still got that problem, right? I put the hoodie on for a reason today. But we've still got that thing where, all of these attackers are computer geniuses. They're hackers. You can't catch them. They're ghosts in the system. No. That's the biggest lie. The second lie is that you need all of these exotic tools and services to protect your environment. No, you need to do just the base level of things. You need to do the nuts and bolts of what needs to be done.
Brett, who's it harder to con? A cynical boomer like myself or a digitally native Gen Z or Gen Z for you?
To me, I always liked those people who thought they could not be scammed. That's what I always liked. I always thought those environments that were secure and we can't be gotten, that would be the person that I'd always want. The digitally native guy, you can get him or her. You can do that. The cynical person, you can do the same. You know, I talk about social engineering a lot because as crime and more people have entered into the crime sphere or the attack sphere, we've started to understand that it boils down to social engineering, a lot of this stuff. Social engineering is about listening and reacting on the fly, adapting to that conversation, whether it be through text or phishing or phone or what have you. It's adapting to that conversation as you need to adapt to it. That's what a social engineer is. It's doing the smallest thing possible to get the person on the other end of the line to respond thinking that they're making the choice when it's actually you that's making the choice. So any of those people can be gotten. And that's not that, I'm sorry, that's not a quick fire answer, but that's the answer.
If we could go back in time, let's go back to the first podcast we did back in 2019. And if you could give the good guys one warning that you felt they would actually listen to, what would it have been?
Going back in time with the knowledge that I have today, and it's not just good guys in cyber, but it's good people across the line, I would say that it's important to speak up. Bad things happen because good people remain silent. I don't care what vertical, I don't care if it's social, political, or economic, bad things happen because good people remain silent. I'm the person that, for some damn reason, I'm the person that right now is saying a lot of stuff that no one else will say because they're scared of consequences. They're scared of losing money or friends or a job. And at the end of the day, you've got to be willing to accept the consequences of doing the right damn thing. And so right now we're at a position where a lot of people are not doing that.
And Brett, we're going to have to leave it there, I'm afraid. It's been fantastic talking to you again. Thank you so much for talking us through so many of those different issues. Always a pleasure. Thank you for spending the time.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Thank you for listening. We'll be back next week with more expert insights and thought-provoking discussions. But in the meantime, if you really enjoyed today's episode, please take a moment to rate, review, and share the podcast. If you're interested in becoming an ISF member or continuing the conversation further, please do get in touch with me at steve.durbin@securityforum.org, or indeed get hold of me on LinkedIn. And remember, you can explore all our media and resources at our website, securityforum.org.